You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor, at gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Alistair McLeod with me once again. Alistair has a background as a stockbroker, banker, and economist. He's a senior fellow at Gold Money Foundation and head of research there. His weekly articles are written at goldmoney.com, and I would urge you to go there to read them, because they are, if you really care to scratch beneath the surface to understand why markets are doing what they're doing, Alistair is as good as anybody to go to understand the workings of the markets. And he definitely is a free market advocate, a free market economist, and they're all too rare these days. So that's why we're really glad to have him with us again. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
Always good to talk to you. And I would like to sort of have you talk about your recent, I think it was mid-April, discussion on deflation and inflation, the debate. It always rages on, and you know, there are people that are just, you know, it's almost like religion and politics among some people that are active market participants. They get emotional about it sometimes. You know, I have a subscriber of mine and a cotton farmer in Texas who is adamantly concerned, but believing that we're heading into another 2008-2009 deflationary episode that's going to take prices of everything down. All I can say is that it seems as though that isn't usually what happens. It may be for a short period of time, and then they start pumping the money into the system again, and then we start having rising prices again. But first of all, before we get started, various definitions of inflation, of course. The Austrians have one, which I think is probably the one that you're more in tune with, the Austrian economist, and of course then the Keynesians have theirs. But talk to us about the definition. How do you define inflation?
Well, inflation always was an increase in the quantity of money in the economy. Sure. And the effect on prices, which the Keynesians, the neo-Keynesians today think is inflation, actually is just the consequence of monetary inflation. So to call sort of rising prices inflation is a complete misnomer. Unfortunately, the problem with economics is that the definitions have become so fluid, nobody actually really can pin down what is inflation, what is deflation, what do you mean when you're talking about deflation? Do you mean the same as what I mean when we talk about deflation? And what is stagflation? I don't know, what is stagflation? You know, there is so much confusion over this that I would really like to see someone standardize properly what these definitions are. But I don't think it'll ever happen, because, I mean, all we end up with is an argument between people like me, Austrians, classical economists, if you like, saying it is absolutely simple. Inflation is an increase in the quantity of money in circulation. Whereas the Keynesians would say, no, that's completely wrong. Inflation is something that we measure on the CPI. You know, so we're not going to agree, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. And of course, you know, those of us who have to be concerned about paying our rent, putting food on the table, the necessities of life, as opposed to, you know, a lot of the one percenters, the top 1% of our society, they don't have to be concerned about those things. We look at inflation, what we care about inflation is price inflation. That is when food and energy and transportation and medical costs, all those things are rising dramatically. To us, that's inflation. But, you know, the point is that you can print money as we did, as the Fed did, as all the central banks did after 2008, 2009. And we haven't seen until just recently any kind of significant rise in the kind of things that us common folks care about, the price of food and energy and transportation and medical care and education, that sort of thing. So maybe it's hard for people to really agree or to really, you know, for them to care about the Austrian definition of inflation. After all, rising stock prices, aren't they wonderful?
Asset inflation, yes. Yeah, we can blow the gaff on the Keynesian concept. And let us just describe it this way. If you increase the quantity of money in circulation, then as that increased quantity works its way into the economy, what happens is that the purchasing power of that money is going to tend to fall. So if we talk about monetary inflation, what we're really talking about is that your money in the bank, your deposits, they are buying less as a result of monetary debasement than they did before. And this is a completely different thing from calling inflation price inflation, the true inflation, because price inflation is something which doesn't seem to be attached to the debasement of money. It yeah. is something, you know, and the Keynesians take it one ridiculous stage further. They try and persuade you that inflation is good for you. It's not. Being robbed of your wealth is not good for you. It's actually as simple as that.
It might be good for them.
Well, it's good for governments, because where does the wealth go? It goes to the government. It also goes, as you know, as we know, if you've read Cantillon, you also know that it's the first receivers of the money who benefit. So when banks create bank credit, they give that to their preferred customers, and those preferred customers are the first to get the new money in circulation. As they spend it, let's say paying their suppliers, buying in services, paying transportation, whatever it is, those second receivers get it. But meanwhile, the market isn't aware this new money is coming into circulation. The prices are just afterwards. And this is the fraud in the whole thing. And governments are meant to help the disadvantaged in society. But guess what? The disadvantaged in society are always the last people to receive this new money. By the time they get it, it has already driven up the prices because its purchasing power has fallen. And they're sitting there with their wages, which are fixed, what little savings they've got, which have gone down in terms of value, in terms of purchasing power. They really are the victims in this. So you're talking about the one percenters. The one percenters actually do very well out of it, because they're the ones who understand it, and they will go and borrow money at an interest rate which is less than the rate at which the money is being debased, mm-hmm. and transfer the wealth in effect from the savers to themselves, mm-hmm. and they become even more rich, absolutely wonderful. Whereas the wealth transfer is from the little people, from the people who are honest and pay their taxes, from the people who just don't understand how they're being robbed.
Which explains why we have a hollowing out of the middle class, and probably more so in America, at least, than any time since. Maybe exceeding the robber baron days of the 1920s, I don't know. But the credit cycle, you talk about the credit cycle. You've provided a great deal of insight in this show, and I know you do in your missives that you write for Gold Money all the time. You don't talk so much about the business cycle, but a credit cycle. And that credit cycle helps to explain when you can anticipate more price inflation and then when you can start to adjust your investments accordingly, right? Would you care to comment, where are we now, Alistair, in this cycle? We start out, of course, like if you start the cycle at the bottom of after 2008, 2009, the crisis, the credit crisis, the financial crisis, and then you start printing money. That's where I would start the cycle. And then you go on, and for a number of years, you can pump all that money in the system. As we just said, the stock market goes up, the bond market is in a bull market, and people's food prices haven't gone up much, and so people are relatively happy, it seems, although their living standards have been decreasing all that time. But where are we now in this credit cycle, and what is it meaning, and can you tie in what we're seeing in the markets now with where you think we are in the credit cycle?
Yes, of course I can. Firstly, the first thing I would say is that the business cycle, rather like price inflation, is the symptom of the credit cycle. Mm-hmm. The real cycle is the credit cycle. It's not a business cycle. Mm-hmm. It is the production of extra money in the early stages of the credit cycle that sort of appears to stimulate business. But unfortunately, they have to continue to stimulate it, because if you withdraw the stimulation, it is exposed for what it is, just purely hot air. So mm-hmm. consequently, one has to think in terms of the credit cycle to understand the economic fallacies that unfortunately we're subjected to today. Now, in terms of where we are in this, particular stock market, bull market, which mm-hmm. is, if you like, inflated by the credit cycle, has now been, it's pretty well a record for a long time. I don't know how long, but I think it's about 107 months or something. Mm-hmm. This is a very, very long time. And really what it means is that the expansion of credit has in effect gone into inflating asset prices more than it's inflated prices on Main Street. So mm-hmm. that's the first thing to bear in mind. Now, in terms of this very, very long stock market, bull market, this is actually telling us quite clearly that we must be in the later stages of the expansionary phase of the credit cycle. The next stage will be an increase in interest rates to try and control inflation, which suddenly begins to get out of control. This always happens. I don't need to go into the mechanism for it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the sequence of events, which is really the question that you want answered, mm-hmm. the first thing you see towards the end of this expansionary phase is you see that bond prices top out. Why do they top out? They top out because the banks have previously invested in bonds. They have restricted their lending to Main Street, the businesses, the medium and small enterprises, if you like, that there are the engine of our economies. The result is they've expanded their balance sheet into buying U.S. treasuries and perhaps, prime corporate debt. There comes a point where that buying ceases. Now, the moment that buying ceases, prices start softening. So if you're a bank, you're beginning to see losses appear in your bond market, on your bond portfolio. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you've got prices going down on where your balance sheet is exposed. And on the other hand, you're now suddenly getting aware that the underlying economy is beginning to respond, apparently positively, to all that earlier monetary inflation. So what do? You want to lend to businesses who seem to be on a sound footing now. All the ideas of, the last crisis and all the rest of it, you realize that's history. So as a banker, you start moving your focus from bonds into bank lending. So what happens is that you get bond prices falling, and at the same time, you begin to see loans to business, and particularly the medium and small-sized businesses, those ones which are deemed to be perhaps the riskiest customers as far as banks are concerned, they start being offered money by the banks. The banks start competing to lend. Now, there comes a point where as bond prices start falling and yields are rising, that this begins to undermine the equity market. Now, I would say that we're pretty well at that point, because you can see that the major equity indices are struggling to go any higher. Now, what then happens is that this whole thing gets a momentum, because bond yields start rising even further as banks continue to ditch their bond investments. And you will find that, the analysts are saying the earnings outlook for XYZ Inc., it looks fantastic. It's never been better. It's wonderful. And the prospects are good. Yet the prices keep on going down. The share prices keep on going down. Mm-hmm. This is what we're seeing at the moment. So we're at that point, which is the beginning of the bear market in equities. Now, the bear market in equities continues while the underlying economy continues to appear to improve. Mm-hmm. And you will find, though, that you get to a point where bottlenecks in industry and supply chains start appearing. Mm-hmm. You will find there's a shortage of raw materials. You find that prices on Main Street start rising, and they can't even suppress them, if you like, with hedonics in the indices. So you get this sort of situation where suddenly you begin to think, oh my goodness, they're going to have to really jack up interest rates to bring this inflation under control. When they do that, you then find that you get the credit crisis. Because as you raise those interest rates, you raise them to the point where instead of controlling and slowing down the rate of inflation, which is what the central bank hopes, it actually just brings on a credit crisis. Those who have borrowed too much and have invested that money unwisely in their businesses find that their return calculations are no longer correct. Those businesses start going bust. The banks then start reversing their bank lending, and you then have a contraction in bank lending. That is going to happen. Now, coming back to this deflation-inflation debate, mm-hmm. a lot of the deflationists can see this, and they think, well, I can see the point where bank lending is going to contract if we end up going into recession. That is deflationary, which basically means that you should hold dollar, cash dollars. The dollar should go higher. But the problem with that idea is that the one thing we can guarantee, almost as much as we can guarantee the sun is going to rise tomorrow, is that the central banks will chuck money at the problem. And that is what will kill the dollar. I think any, move in towards a stronger dollar on a credit crisis is likely to be extremely short, a lot shorter than last time. Because mm-hmm. last time we just didn't, we weren't sure that Bernanke was actually going to come up with the money to the extent that was required. As it right. was, I calculate he wrote an open check for around about $13 trillion in a $15 trillion economy. This time, we've got a $20 trillion economy. I think we're looking at least $20 trillion of open check support, as it were, for the banks and the businesses that would otherwise go bust. Now, that, I think, is going to undermine the purchasing power of the dollar to the point where not only do you find that the economy is crashing, but the purchasing power of the dollar goes with it?
So the dollar is going to lose its purchasing power. Nothing new there. It's a matter of timing, really, I guess, isn't it? I mean, the dollar could get stronger. It could actually buy a bit more for a short period of time, as it did in 2008, 2009. I think we saw some actual momentarily deflation. Prices fell. A lot of prices fell. But then, so how many more of these cycles can we go through, though, Alistair? Because I was looking today, a 1% rise with a $22 trillion debt level, which is what the U.S. will shortly have, we're going to run a $1.3 trillion deficit next year, according to David Stockman, and the Fed is preparing to take back, according to David, $600 billion out of the market. Rates are set to rise very dramatically, it seems, but it's struggling with a 3% on the 10-year right now, the equity market is. What happens if we go to 4%? How much can it take? And then, so your thought is that it won't last long. They can't go much further, and when it does, they won't have much time, probably, and they'll have to start pumping really quickly again?
Yes, I think that is basically right. Now, as to the timing of the credit crisis, I suspect it will be towards the end of this year. Now, the reason I say that is that I can see that Chinese demand for commodities in particular is going to begin to drive up commodity prices. As well as that, the effect of Trump's stimulus with the tax cuts and all the rest of it, basically what that does is it increases the budget deficit. It mm-hmm. increases the amount of debt issuance required to balance the books, and it also increases the trade deficit. So you can see that with the increased trade deficit, that's going to undermine the dollar. Mm-hmm. With the increased rates of interest, that's going to undermine government finances. And I can see a real crisis developing there. And that crisis reminds me so much of what happened in the UK in 1973-74. That's a wonderful model for what we see.
Okay, we'll have to leave it go at that, Alistair. We're out of time. Always a pleasure having you. I guess, obviously, it's goldmoney.com. Folks, go there to follow Alistair and all he does. Some good advice there. And, of course, he and I both believe that you should own gold. It should be at the core of your portfolio because gold retains its purchasing power forever fiat currencies always go to the dustbin of history. The question is, how soon do we go there? We're out of time this week. That's all the time we do have. Next week, David Stockman is scheduled to be my guest. He will no doubt expand on some of the things that Alistair just talked about. We'll also be talking to one of my company sponsors. Specifically, it's going to be Robert Carrington, I believe. We have a sponsor next week. He'll be with us. Thank you very much, Alistair, for being with us. And folks, until next week, that is all we have time for. Goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.